the building of the Mishkan, I can't say is the most fascinating of topics. Not exactly a riveting narrative. I don't think it's necessarily meant to be riveting. But it is a beautiful structure that they're making. You know, lots of different coverings, very specific engineering. It's cool stuff in terms of that.
I find like the parsha itself is very, very, very bland. Like the commentary on this was frustrating.
There's a lot, yeah, exactly. You were talking to me about the Midrash yesterday. He's giving lots of different symbolisms. For example, what are the tachashim? There's these hides. It's not clear what they're made out of. What is the tachash? And so you have like Midrash and the Gemara talks about, right? It could be from the unicorn. Shadal thinks, what does he say? Orot Tachashim. You know, Shadal says, Tachash lo nimza chutz misipor mishkan rak pam achat. There's only one other time in the entirety of Tanakh where the word Tachash actually comes up again. Where is that? Orot Tachashim, actually. Right? Orot Tachashim. There's only one place in all of Tanakh, besides for the building of the Mishkan, where it comes up, which is in Yechezkel 6, Tetzayin. Yud. I will shod you. I guess that means like to put on one's feet the tachash. So what is that? So he says, Lidat Mitargamim, he says, in the opinion of the translators, I guess like maybe Unculus, maybe others, I don't know, who shame or tzvua b'tzeva miyuchad. It's to indicate it's a special colored hide. Or a special colored leather that's like unlike other colors. V'chendat busart. Busart also believe this. Chachmei Talmud Omru, but the rabbis of the Talmud meeting in Shabbos Chavkat, Shehu Shem Chaya. He says it's the name of an animal of some kind. Doesn't name which animal. V'chendat Jezinius. And apparently Jezinius also says similarly. V'hu Omer Shu Poka. I don't know what that is. I'm looking in the Dan Klein. He says, Foka is a genus of seals or the like. What? The tachash is made from seal leather, perhaps. It happens to be, it's what's interesting is that if you look at Shadal's translation into Italian, apparently he translated it as badger skins with a question mark. He wasn't sure. But he doesn't even name that here. That's what's interesting. He doesn't say that in the commentary. He doesn't mention badgers.
Well, that would be an interesting animal to have seals because like geographically.
Well, which ones? The seals or the badgers? Seals would be difficult to find in the desert, that's for sure. I don't know. Can you find seals in Egypt? Like in the various places near Egypt? I don't know. Does the Mediterranean have seals? yeah, good question. I don't know. Also, badgers would probably be difficult to find. Unicorns are even more difficult, I think. in terms of locating them.
But it's an example of something that we have no idea the geographical...
That's true. It could be anywhere. Or it could be a metaphor, symbol. There's a Rav Kook on that, I remember, in Inaya. That's very interesting. Okay. So that's one idea is the tachash. Second thing is, what are the kruvim? So... You might have grown up. What are the kruvim that are put on top of the aron? They have wings, apparently. What do you mean? They look like angels? Do angels have a look to them?
Yes, the kruvim.
Right, so the Gemara doesn't assume that they're the image of angels. By the way, the Rambam says that if you make an image of angels, you're actually violating Avodah Zarah.
So the Midrash says it was the only time the Jews were allowed to make a statue.
Right. So, like, there's different midrashim. I saw Chizkuni. Chizkuni is a Rishon. Very interesting. Usually quoting other people. I don't know who he's quoting, if he's quoting anybody for this. But the Chizkuni says, how is it possible that two parshas ago we're told never to make a graven image of anything, and then all of a sudden in this parsha we're putting in the Kodesh HaKodashim. I thought of Avodah Zarah is awesome. So he says, for everything in Judaism, there is always one exception to the rule. So, for example, you're not allowed to, the Gemara talks about this. I think it's Rav Nachman's wife notes this. She says, you're not allowed. A woman is not allowed to marry her brother-in-law. But if her husband should die without children, then they are now in Yibum together. So that's permitted. There's a case where it's permitted. Or, for example, you're not allowed to have meat and milk. But she says you're allowed to eat udder. Udder, which is like, she considers this like, you know, the udder of a cow.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Which is...
You're allowed to eat udder?
Apparently, yeah. That is like, she considers that, at least, the wife of Rav Nachman, as like absorbed of milk. It is milk in meat form, and yet you're allowed to cook it and have it, and you don't have to worry about it. So like, there's lots of exceptions. There's always one exception to every rule. So here, there's an exception to every to the rule of Avodah Zarah, where we're putting in the Kodesh HaKadosh. Right, so it's interesting. The Shaddal actually, throughout this Parsha, talks about how, like, for example, this is an interesting one. I'll just tell you from the English. He says in Chaf He Chaf Tes, he says, it says you're going to be making its plates and bowls and goblets and libation vessels. What does Shaddal say on this? He says, the explanations given by the rabbis and Rashi for these vessels appear to conform with what existed in the Second Temple, but not that which existed in the desert. Meaning, according to Shaddal, the description here is very different than the one that actually is created. And a lot, even the vessels themselves, not just the structure of the house. But in the Second Temple, there were many different things that differed, you know, that it may be not on purpose, maybe just historical circumstances. It's a very fascinating comment from Shaddal that you might see descriptions of the Beis HaMikdash later on in Tanakh that might not accord with how we're describing the Mishkan here. Okay, so we're talking about the Kruvim. So, say it looks like angels. So, the Gemara in Sukkah says, where does the word Kruvim come from according to the Gemara? It's Kirubia. A Rubia is a child. We actually recreate that. I think when we eat the Simanim on Rosh Hashanah, right, you have Rubia, which is what? Is it Fenugreek? I always forget which one is which. Similar to the word Puruvu, right, Uruvu. Kirubia means it should look like a child with wings, because it's described as having wings, right? And it's Shaddal does not agree with that, right? Rashi says, does he say anything? Yeah, he says demut partsuf tinok lahem. It had the face. It was a bird or some kind of being like with wings, with the face of a child. So maybe not the body of a child. However, Shaddal actually is going to emphasize how the Torah tries to take you away. Intentionally, you have to quite. So that doesn't explain why we have these Kruvim on top. However, at least not here. However, he does try to show how the Torah itself is trying to de-emphasize the Kruvim, which is interesting. De-emphasize the Kruvim. So first here he says Kruvim. So where does that word come from? He thinks it actually is kamo hafuch rachuv. It is switching around the letters forms the word rachuv. Now he's not just doing gematrias and stuff. He means sometimes this happens where the letters switch around. It does happen in terms of like certain words will be very similar. It'll just be a resh instead of a lamed. Okay, I'm trying to think of an example, a good example right now. Nothing's coming to me. But he says kama hafuch rachuv. The idea is that it's a mix around. It's a turnaround of the word rachuv. What does rachuv mean, or rechav, or rachav? It means to ride. And so kisvart. Jesitius, I guess it's not Jesinius. The Achacham Yashar, that's Regio. Bikure Etim, okay. So the idea is that it means the word to ride, a ridden thing. Rak Loli Yotam Murkavim Mitzurat Shonot. But Regio thought that it actually comes from the word Harkava. Harkava means a composite of several things. Sometimes you'll find in the Gemara, it'll talk about transplanting one tree branch onto another tree to produce new fruit. We actually worry about that when it comes to etrogim, and one of the concepts there is harkava, is transplantation or compositing, creating a mixture of two things. So I don't know what Reggio meant by that, what Shaddal is referring to, but it could be that he thought because it has maybe a body or face of a baby and wings, it's a composite of different forms. Or maybe there's like, you know, the Yecheskel dream of like a four-headed beast of some kind. I don't know. I don't know what he was referring to there. But so he says, Shaddal says, it is not does not come from the same word of harkava, which, right, resh chaf bet, which is Reggio's thinking that Kruvim, or Karuv, comes from Harkava. But rather, Ki Lashon Harkava Lahora Kizo, for Harkava to mean that, Ki Lashon Shibadu Lahem Achronim, that's much later. That comes, you'll never, I guess he argues, you won't find that in Tanakh. You won't find that at least in the Torah, where the word harkava refers to actual, like, making a composite. It's a later word. So you won't find the kruvin meaning that. Can't be. Okay. Ach nikru uken, so why is it called rachuv, or like to be ridden? Memne shehem rachav Elohim. It's the ride of God. It's God's car, so to speak. Meaning it's a, there's imagery of God riding the kruvin. Where do we find that? Kitam vayirkav al karuv. In Tehillim Yudchet Yud Alef, it says that God rides the cherub. Now, you know, there could be all sorts of symbolism here. We could be talking about the cherub, the kruvim refers to knowledge and the fences to knowledge. Like, for example, in the garden, in front of the Garden of Eden, you have kruvim placed there when Adam and Chava are kicked out. Kruvim are placed there, and there's a flaming sword spinning every which way. So you can understand it as, you know, the blocks of knowledge, maybe in our own lives and whatever. You can create symbolism of what exactly it would mean, and, like, you know, to trust in God because he rides the kruvim. He's in control of that knowledge and those blocks. And he says also, it's in Divrei Yamim Aleph Chav Chet Yud Chet, it says, L'tavnita merkava hakruvim zahav, which means, and the image of the chariot, the golden kruvim. So you have this description of the chariot of God having kruvim upon it, right? Again, this is symbolism, but the idea is that that's where the word kruvim comes from, which means that he rejects the idea that there's a baby face on this. Like, it has nothing to do with the idea of rubia, of having to do with children. Very interesting. Well, moving on to Chaf, he says, I think we can even find even more explicit, even though he never actually says what it looks like, as far as I can find. But it says, in Chaf, it says, El kaporet yiyu pnei akruvim. Upon the kaporet, you'll find the facing of the kruvim. He says, notim at lamata. What it means is that the kruvim are facing a little bit downward. Like the Ibn Ezra says, akruvim ayu porshim kanfeim. So what the kruvim would have, I think he understands that it's just a stomp bird. It's a bird, and its wings are spread out, limala, like above, ki ilu mo'afafim, as if it's about to take flight. V'yamnam ein akruvim demut ha'el chalila. God forbid that you should think that the kruvim are supposed to look like God in any way. It's not what we're doing. We're not trying to make an image of God. El kamoshara yichaskol. The idea is like what Ezekiel saw. She'al roshei ha'chayot haya demut rakia. The idea is that upon the heads of the animals that he saw in his dream was the rakia, was the firmament. And then above that was the throne of glory. And above that was the Shekhinah. So the idea is, like, there is these different divine images, divine symbolisms. And we're going higher and higher. So the kruvim are like part of that divine symbolism, not to symbolize God, but actually the things that are lower than God, the different various divine worlds. What's the need for that? Again, he doesn't explain, unfortunately. But, okay. So he says, that's what the kruvim are. Okay, they have wings. They're about to take flight. That's what it looks like. They're facing somewhat down. And then he notes, the next one, Chaf Aleph, a very interesting note with this one. Right? He says, in Chaf Aleph, I'll read you the pasuk. It says, V'nasata al kaporet al aron milmala. This is how Shadal translates it, okay? You will place the cover on top of the ark, and within the ark, you will place the admonition, meaning the edut, right? The testimony, but he translates it as a declaration of something, that I will give you. Meaning you're going to put in the lucho, you're going to put the Torah in this aron. Why does God make sure to say that when you make these kruvim, and that's going to be above the aron, and then within the aron you're going to put in the luchot. We actually already know that, and it's emphasizing again and again that we're putting the Torah in this. The next pasuk says, "V'no'adati lecha sham," and I will meet you there. Right? God says, I will speak to you from this area, from this aron. I will. This will be the place where you should come and get prophecy from me. Okay? V'dibarti itcha me'al kaporet. I will speak to you from above the kaporet. Mibein shnei hakruvim. Between the kruvim. As if, like, the kruvim are part of this prophetic vision. Okay, Asher al Aron Adit, which will be above the Aron. Et kol Asher atzavetcha al bnei Yisrael, everything that I will command you. Okay, so what does Shaddal say? Shaddal says this: the entire point of emphasizing what God will put, that what you're supposed to put into the Aron, is exactly to downplay the role of the Kruvim. What does he say? He says, "Kodem sha'amar v'nodati l'cha sham v'dibarti itcha me'al kaporet." Before God says the Kruvim and the Kaporet are going to be really important because I'm going to communicate through that. Chazar v'hiskir mash nitan b'tocha aron. He went back or repeated that which he said you're supposed to put into the aron, which is lodia ki kedushat aron hi ba'avor luchot. You know what makes this aron holy? It's not the Kruvim. It's not the kapora. It's not the gold and the various objects that are this aron is made up of. Rather, it is the luchot that you're going to put inside of it, which makes it holy. What makes it holy? Because it's the commands that you're supposed to do. Shabbatocho lo b'shvil kaporet ha-kruvim. The kruvim and the kaporet are not the things that are going to actually make it holy. Those are not the emphasis here. So therefore, God emphasizes the fact that the luchot should be put in. Very fascinating. So even though the Kruvim take a little bit of a place here and a little bit of emphasis, Shaddal thinks that it's being downplayed by the Torah. Don't think that that is the cause of the Kedusha. It's there for whatever reason that Shaddal doesn't explain here, but it's there. But that's not the actual cause for holiness and the importance of this Aron. This is the place I'm picking so that you can come to me and I can give you the commandments. I will note, though, that there's an interesting image in the Baal HaTorim about the Kruvim. He thinks that they are actually the image of two Chavrusas duking it out. So two Chavrusas having a battle of wits, a battle of who's right in understanding the Halacha, which for me is a very powerful image. That's where God is found, between those two things. That's where God communicates to man, is through the battle of halacha and trying to determine what the truth is. That's where we can find our connection to God. Okay, shkoyach.